Astory Publishing presents Balancing the Risk Equation. Prologue. Before sunrise on a blustery March morning in 1952, a young doctoral candidate named Harry Markowitz stepped through the stone archway of the University of Chicago's Harper Library. His manuscript, thin pages inked with variances, covariances, and an unfamiliar phrase he called efficient frontier, felt almost weightless in his satchel. Yet the ideas inside would soon demand the attention of every institution that dared to multiply money by mathematics. Across the reading room, a coal-fired radiator hissed and the glow of a single desk lamp pooled over Markowitz's notes. He paused, struck by a simple revelation. Risk did not live inside an individual stock. It sprang from how a constellation of assets swayed together. That insight, so compact it could fit on the back of a postcard, began a quiet revolution. Half a century later, in a glass-walled office 37 floors above Lower Manhattan, portfolio manager Marcus Ortega skimmed the pre-market headlines. Oil futures were limit down, and a currency shock rippled across emerging markets. Ortega's screen blinked crimson, yet the models he relied upon whispered reassurance. Correlations among the fund's holdings were low. Value at risk remained inside mandate, and the overnight losses, though dramatic, were already anticipated in the tail of last night's simulation run. Markowitz's postcard, translated into terabytes, had traveled from pen and paper to real-time code. Two time zones west, at the Oregon Public Employees Retirement Fund, Chief Risk Officer Lisa Chen walked into the boardroom clutching a slide deck stamped confidential. Her trustees, teachers, firefighters, and civil engineers by trade, faced a dilemma ordinary savers know too well, promised generous benefits in a world of tepid yields. Chen's task was to show how blending market beta with disciplined tilts toward value, momentum, and low volatility could stretch return without inflating anxiety. She rehearsed the opening sentence in her head. Diversification is no longer an option. It is the price of keeping our promises. The urgency behind her words was not theatrical. If the fund fell short by even 1 percentage point a year, liabilities would eclipse assets within a decade. Far from those high-stakes chambers, a graduate student named Sofia Alvarez hunched over a borrowed laptop in her campus cafe. Steam from her coffee fogged the screen as she typed the final formula into a blank spreadsheet. Equals SQM mult, M mult, covar, transpose W. The matrix sprang to life, tracing a gentle curve that bowed outward like a sail catching wind, the efficient frontier. Sophia exhaled. For weeks, she had wrestled with Python errors, split adjustments, and the stubborn mystery of why her covariance matrix refused to remain symmetric. Now the frontier gleamed in perfect order, and with it emerged a realization. The math was accessible, but the discipline to guard it against bad data and careless assumptions was not. Four individuals, four vantage points, all orbiting the same gravitational pull. The promise that statistics can tame uncertainty and convert it into reward. Their stories converge on a single, unsettling question. In markets that trade faster than headlines, where algorithms mine satellite images for crop yields and social sentiment for momentum cues, can the classical grammar of variance and correlation still protect real money, retirement checks, tuition endowments, hospital reserves, from the next storm? Or will unseen dependencies expose portfolios that look tranquil on paper but tremble under stress? History offers mixed counsel. The dot-com crash punished those who mistook soaring tech shares for steady compounding. The financial crisis of 2008 humbled institutions that trusted Gaussian estimates blind to liquidity spirals. Yet each catastrophe also validated Markowitz's core message. Portfolios that blended imperfectly related assets fell, but they fell less. The math did not fail. Assumptions about the world that fed the math did. This book opens on that tension. It will follow Markowitz's lineage from chalkboard to cloud server, pausing where theory meets peril, when beta underestimates crash risk, when a momentum signal quietly flips sign, when a misprinted corporate action distorts an entire factor sleeve. Along the way, the narrative will introduce a cast of actors, statisticians, coders, regulators, and skeptics, each wrestling with the same paradox. To squeeze more return from capital, they must embrace complexity. To survive complexity, they must carve it into quantities simple enough to monitor at dawn before the opening bell. For the listener, the journey begins here, in the moment just before Chen clicks to her first slide, before Ortega's algorithms decide whether to unwind a position, before Sophia submits her thesis, and before the next graduate somewhere rediscovers Markowitz's deceptively plain equations. The Cathedral of Quantitative Investing stands ready, its foundation poured from variance, covariance, and correlation. The lights are on, the machines are humming, and the door is ajar. Step through and consider what it means, mathematically, economically, and ethically, to balance risk against reward when the future remains stubbornly unpriced. End of prologue. Before we can speak with any precision about advanced asset pricing or multi-factor portfolios, we must first agree on the statistical language that Harry Markowitz placed at the center of investment analysis during the early 1950s. At its heart, modern portfolio theory asks a single practical question. How much reward can an investor reasonably demand for accepting a given amount of uncertainty? To answer, we need clear measures for both reward and uncertainty. Expected return provides the reward side. Variance, covariance, and correlation quantify the uncertainty side. When combined, these measures reveal why holding several imperfectly related assets together can lower overall volatility without necessarily sacrificing expected return. This opening section therefore builds a shared vocabulary, moving step by step from the simplest dispersion measure to the full diversification logic that later chapters will extend and refine. To put the importance of variance into perspective, consider the experience of investors in the technology-heavy NASDAQ Composite Index during the late 1990s. As the index soared, some investors felt they were achieving steady, predictable returns, only to see the bubble burst and volatility spike. Variance captures this sort of uncertainty, providing a foundation for understanding how risk compounds when assets are combined. Variance is calculated by taking any asset, labeling its periodic return R, and calling the long-run average of those returns mu. The variance, denoted verbally as sigma squared, equals the expected value of the square of the difference between R and mu. In simpler terms, we first subtract the average return from each individual observation, square that difference so that positive and negative deviations are treated symmetrically, and then average the resulting squares. The squaring accomplishes two tasks. It eliminates any canceling out between positive and negative surprises, and it magnifies larger surprises relative to smaller ones. The outcome, variance, carries units of return squared, so we often take the square root, called standard deviation or simply volatility, when we wish to speak in the same units as the original returns. Still, the squared form plays the starring role in portfolio mathematics because it integrates gracefully with the algebra of combining assets. The historical relationship between the returns on United States equities and those on investment-grade corporate bonds illustrates covariance. During the 1980s and 1990s, these two asset classes often moved in tandem, as both benefited from declining interest rates and a stable macroeconomic environment, resulting in a positive covariance. Covariance is the statistic that tells us how two separate return streams move together. Imagine returns on asset A and asset B, with respective long-run averages mu sub A and mu sub B. Covariance equals the expected value of the product of two deviations, the deviation of A from its own mean times the deviation of B from its mean. If both assets tend to rise or fall in tandem, the product of their deviations will be positive more often than negative, yielding a positive covariance. If one tends to rise while the other falls, the product becomes negative more frequently, and the covariance turns negative. A covariance near zero indicates no systematic co-movement. Although covariance retains squared units and can therefore be awkward to interpret directly, its magnitude is essential because portfolio variance depends on it. To eliminate the unit problem and allow direct comparison across asset pairs, we normalize covariance by the product of the two individual standard deviations, resulting in correlation, symbolized by the Greek letter rho. Correlation is a standardized version of covariance, making it easier to compare the strength of the relationship between different pairs of assets. It is unitless and bounded between -1 and +1. A correlation of +1 means the two assets always move proportionally in the same direction. -1 means they always move proportionally in opposite directions. 0 suggests independent movement. Because correlation is simply a rescaled covariance, any conclusion about diversification potential that we can draw from one can just as readily be drawn from the other. Practitioners tend to prefer correlation when scanning large tables for diversification opportunities, though the underlying optimization formulas almost always work with raw covariance. With these definitions established, we can describe how a portfolio's total variance combines individual variances and pairwise covariances. Consider a portfolio containing just two assets, A and B, with weights W(A) and W(B) that sum to 1. The portfolio variance equals W(A) squared times the variance of A, plus W(B) squared times the variance of B, plus 2 times W(A) times W(B) times the covariance between A and B. The covariance between two assets is influenced by their individual volatilities and the correlation between them. The key takeaway is that when covariance is less than the product of the individual volatilities, the total portfolio variance falls below the weighted average of the two individual variances. In plain English, if the two assets fail to move perfectly together, a mixed portfolio can be less volatile than either component taken alone, even when both components are themselves quite erratic. A concrete, historically documented example illustrates this concept. Throughout the late 1990s, broad United States equities exhibited annualized volatility close to the high teens in percentage terms, whereas investment-grade foreign sovereign bonds, when expressed in dollar terms, displayed volatility in roughly the mid-single digits. The correlation between those two return streams averaged only modestly positive, well below 1, because bond prices often responded to global interest rate cycles rather than the corporate earnings cycle dominating equity returns. An investor who allocated 60% to domestic equities and 40% to foreign bonds found that the portfolio's calculated variance fell meaningfully beneath what a simple weighted average of the two standalone variances would suggest. The joint variance declined because the cross-product term, containing both the weight product and the subunity correlation, subtracted risk from the mixture. Meanwhile, the expected return of the combined holdings remained competitive with a fully domestic equity allocation because bonds contributed a steady coupon stream as well as occasional capital gains during equity drawdowns. This is the numerical essence behind the remark that diversification is the only free lunch in finance. Markowitz generalized the two-asset intuition into a many-asset optimization problem. For a portfolio of N assets, one must account for every individual variance and every unique covariance pair. If N equals 20, for instance, there are still only 20 variances but 190 unique covariances, highlighting how rapidly the number of relationships expands. By assigning weights to minimize variance for each possible expected return level, or equivalently maximize expected return for each variance level, one traces a curved boundary in risk-return space known as the efficient frontier. Portfolios on the frontier are efficient in that no other feasible portfolio offers a higher expected return for the same variance or a lower variance for the same expected return. Those beneath the frontier are suboptimal. Rational investors should never hold them once the frontier is known. Constructing the frontier requires three building blocks: an expected return vector, a variance-covariance matrix, and a set of constraints that typically force the weights to sum to 1 and disallow negative weightings if short selling is unavailable. Quadratic programming routines embedded in common spreadsheet solvers handle the mathematics, but an intuitive grasp of each component remains indispensable. The expected return vector summarizes reward assumptions. the covariance matrix captures every diversifying relationship. The optimization engine then searches for weight combinations that exploit low or negative covariances to reduce overall volatility without unduly sacrificing expected return. Understanding the efficient frontier empowers investors to make informed decisions about their risk-return trade-offs. The more assets an investor can include, and the lower the average pairwise correlation among them, the more the frontier bows outward, yielding attractive opportunities for portfolios that deliver respectable returns at surprisingly low volatility. At this juncture, listeners might reasonably ask, what ensures that the historical correlations we measure will persist? Decades of empirical study suggest that broad economic forces, such as central bank policy, corporate earnings cycles, and commodity shocks, exhibit semi-stable patterns that prevent correlations from leaping overnight from strongly negative to strongly positive. Thoughtful diversification intentionally combines assets driven by distinct economic drivers. Even moderate instability in any single correlation seldom erodes the entire diversification benefit. In later sections, we will examine ways to stress test these relationships and protect portfolios when correlations spike during crises. For now, the lesson is that diversification relies on less than perfect correlation, not on heroic forecasting of any exact numerical value. To recap, we have established three cornerstone equations. Variance equals the expected value of the squared deviation of returns from their mean. Covariance equals the expected value of the product of the deviations of two asset returns from their respective means. Correlation equals covariance divided by the product of the two standard deviations, yielding a unitless measure bounded between negative one and positive one. With these tools, we can measure individual risk, joint risk, and the strength of co-movement, quantitatively demonstrating why mixing assets delivers what feels like magic, but is, in truth, pure arithmetic. Equipped with variance, covariance, and correlation, we are now prepared to explore the efficient frontier, the capital asset pricing relation, and eventually, the multi-factor frameworks that dominate contemporary quantitative investing. Each subsequent model or risk metric will refer back to the simple definitions laid out here, forming the foundation for every sophisticated technique that follows. Modern portfolio theory, which we explored in the opening section, tells us how to mix assets efficiently once their expected returns are known. What it doesn't tell us is why one asset should be expected to earn more than another in the first place. The capital asset pricing model, usually abbreviated as CAPM, supplies that missing bridge by linking every individual security to a single common benchmark, the broad market portfolio. Think of the market portfolio as a giant, all-encompassing basket that contains every investable asset, with each asset's weight determined by its total market value. In doing so, CAPM introduces three working concepts, beta, expected return, and alpha, that have shaped professional investment conversations for more than half a century. Our task in the next several minutes is to derive these terms verbally, examine the assumptions that support them, and show how each statistic guides real-world asset selection and weighting. We begin with the central intuition. If investors can hold a perfectly diversified market portfolio at negligible cost, any extra risk that remains inside a single stock must be risk that cannot be eliminated through diversification. Such risk is called systematic. All other risk, the idiosyncratic sort that diversification washes away, should command no compensation once portfolios are large enough. CAPM formalizes this intuition by stating in words that the expected return on any security equals the risk-free rate of interest plus a single surcharge that compensates investors for bearing systematic risk. The surcharge equals the security's beta multiplied by the market risk premium. Beta, therefore, measures how aggressively the security's return co-moves with the return on the aggregate market. For instance, consider a utility company whose stock tends to be less volatile than the overall market. It might have a beta below one, indicating that it is less sensitive to market fluctuations. To see precisely where beta comes from, Recall our covariance definition from earlier. Covariance measures the tendency of two return streams to swing together. Variance is simply the covariance of a return series with itself. With those foundations, we can write, again entirely in words, beta equals the covariance of the security's return with the market return divided by the variance of the market return. In plain language, we tally how often the security and the market move together, then scale that tally by how volatile the market itself happens to be. If a stock's beta equals 1, the stock, on average, advances or declines in lockstep with the market. If beta is below 1, the stock wiggles less than the market. If beta exceeds 1, its swings are amplified. Because the denominator of the ratio is always positive, the sign of beta is determined by the sign of the covariance. Negative betas can and do occur for companies whose fortunes tend to brighten when the overall market dims, although such companies are rare. Gold mining stocks sometimes exhibit negative betas because their value often increases when the market declines. The derivation of the full pricing equation follows naturally. Imagine an investor able to borrow or lend at the risk-free rate while also trading the broad market portfolio. She can combine those two ingredients to mimic any linear payoff pattern that loads solely on market risk. If a third security offered a different expected return than this replicating combination, while bearing the identical amount of market risk, an arbitrage opportunity would emerge. Rational traders would bid up or sell down the mispriced security until parity was restored. The consequence is the celebrated verbal equation. Expected return equals the risk-free rate plus beta times the difference between the expected market return and the risk-free rate. That difference is the market risk premium. To illustrate, suppose the risk-free rate is 2%, the expected market return is 8%, and a particular stock has a beta of 1.2, its expected return would then be 2% plus 1.2 times 6, which equals 9.2%. Because every term on the right-hand side is observable, or at least estimable, the relation furnishes a powerful benchmark. When the realized or forecast return on a security diverges meaningfully from the CAPM prediction, investors have a concrete signal that either the security is mispriced or one of the underlying inputs has been misestimated. Alpha enters the story as that very divergence. Suppose we regress the historical monthly returns of a mid-capitalization technology firm on the contemporaneous returns of a broad-based equity index over, say, 60 such months. The regression intercept is called alpha, while the slope coefficient is beta. A statistically significant positive intercept indicates that the firm delivered returns above what its beta alone would warrant. That extra piece, alpha, becomes shorthand for skill, insight, or structural advantage, provided it persists out of sample. Imagine analyzing a tech fund that shows an alpha of 3%. This means it outperformed its benchmark by 3 percentage points annually after adjusting for its beta. Michael Jensen's 1968 doctoral dissertation sharpened this concept by proposing what is now labeled Jensen's alpha. Rather than relying solely on the regression intercept, Jensen compared a portfolio's realized average return with the return predicted by its measured beta and the realized market premium over the same horizon. Put differently, Jensen's alpha equals the actual return minus the sum of the risk-free rate and beta times the realized market excess return. A positive value indicates that the manager added value beyond market movements. A negative value indicates value destruction. The metric proved immediately attractive to pension trustees and endowment boards because it permits apples-to-apples comparison across managers running portfolios with widely varying betas. For example, a concentrated growth manager might carry a beta of 1.4, while a defensive income manager might sit near 0.6. Raw return alone would favor the aggressive manager in bull markets. Yet Jensen's alpha neutralizes that beta handicap, isolating true skill. All of these neat relationships rest on several explicit assumptions. Markets must be frictionless, no transaction costs, no taxes, and unlimited borrowing or short selling at the risk-free rate. Investors must agree on a single joint distribution of future returns, implying homogeneous expectations. Everyone must share a single period horizon, meaning they care only about the mean and variance of end-of-period wealth and not the path taken to get there. Finally, returns must be jointly normally distributed, or investors must exhibit quadratic utility so that mean and variance fully describe their preferences. While these assumptions are stringent, research has shown that the simple beta-based model still explains a meaningful share of cross-sectional return variation, especially over longer horizons and among large liquid securities. For instance, a portfolio manager who tilts toward higher beta stocks in anticipation of a bull market should, according to CAPM, both increase expected return and assume greater systematic risk. With the derivations and assumptions in place, we can now trace how each metric steers portfolio construction. We start with expected return. In a world where CAPM holds exactly, the only source of variation in expected return across securities is beta. A manager seeking higher expected portfolio return need only tilt weights toward higher beta stocks. Conversely, a cautious manager can pull portfolio risk and expected return down simultaneously by favoring lower beta names or by combining the market portfolio with lending at the risk-free rate. Notice that the optimization problem becomes trivial. Once the market portfolio and the risk-free asset are available, every efficient portfolio lies somewhere on the straight line connecting those two points in risk-return space, a line often called the capital market line. The slope of that line equals the market Sharpe ratio, and beta determines where on the line any individual security projects. A conservative investor might thus allocate a larger portion of capital to low beta stocks, thereby reducing overall volatility. Alpha introduces a second layer. Suppose a stock shows a beta of 1.2, yet delivers an average excess return higher than that beta would justify. The positive alpha suggests the stock lies above the capital market line. Rational alpha-seeking investors will overweight it relative to a purely beta-driven allocation because doing so elevates expected portfolio return without increasing systematic risk proportionally. However, they must also recognize that alpha estimates are noisy. A single year of apparently outsized performance could easily stem from luck. Confidence intervals widen quickly as the estimation window shortens or the asset's idiosyncratic volatility rises. Prudent practitioners therefore demand that alphas be both economically meaningful and statistically significant before allowing large deviations from market cap weights. In practice, an investor might require a stock to display a statistically significant alpha at the 95% confidence level before granting it an overweight. Jensen's alpha, being computed at the portfolio level, informs whether active management as a whole has added value. Consider a diversified mutual fund that reports a 5-year annualized return of, say, 9% above treasury bills. If the same period's market premium averaged 6% and the fund's beta measured 1.1, Jensen's alpha would be 9 minus 1.1 times 6, which equals 2.4%. The positive figure suggests the manager beat the benchmark after adjusting for risk. An institutional asset allocator comparing multiple funds can rank them by Jensen's alpha, thereby rewarding genuine skill rather than blind risk-taking. Beyond manager selection, beta and alpha guide dynamic weighting decisions inside multi-asset portfolios. Imagine an endowment committee debating whether to increase its allocation to listed real estate investment trusts. Historical analysis shows that the sector's beta against the broad equity market is roughly 0.7, meaning it dampens portfolio volatility relative to holding more equities. However, if the sector's forward-looking alpha appears negative, perhaps owing to poor fundamentals or overextended valuations, the committee might choose to maintain or even underweight the exposure despite the attractive beta profile. Conversely, a segment such as small capitalization industrials might carry a beta above 1, yet offer compelling positive alpha due to structural underrepresentation in passive benchmarks. the committee may accept the extra volatility in exchange for the expected alpha contribution, provided that the overall portfolio's beta remains within policy limits. In quantitative asset allocation models, beta often serves as the first-pass filter. Securities or factors with unstable or excessively high betas can cause total portfolio risk to breach constraints. Once beta boundaries are set, optimization routines search for assets with the highest ratio of estimated alpha to idiosyncratic variance, a measure sometimes called the information ratio. Because alpha forecasts are scarce and error-prone, combining many small positive alpha positions usually yields a more reliable boost to expected return than making a heroic bet on a single large alpha. The mathematics mirrors diversification logic. Uncorrelated estimation errors cancel, raising the probability that the aggregate alpha will materialize. A portfolio manager might therefore use an optimization algorithm to identify a mix of stocks with attractive information ratios, maximizing expected alpha while controlling idiosyncratic risk. Critics of CAPM note that empirical tests often uncover systematic deviations. Low beta stocks have tended to outperform the model's predictions, while extreme high beta stocks have underperformed, a pattern dubbed the low beta anomaly. Multifactor extensions, which we will explore in later sections, attempt to repair these shortcomings by adding size, value, momentum, and other traits as additional explanatory variables. Even the most elaborate models retain beta, expected return, and alpha at their core. When a new factor is introduced, its payoff is measured as a slope coefficient analogous to beta, and any residual performance beyond those factors is again labeled alpha. The widely cited Fama-French three-factor model, for example, augments the original market beta with size and value factors to provide a more nuanced explanation of stock returns. Before proceeding, let us address an often overlooked practical point: data frequency. Beta and alpha estimates obtained from daily returns may diverge materially from those derived using monthly or quarterly data. Microstructure noise, non-synchronous trading, and bid-ask bounce inflate high-frequency volatility, biasing beta downward for less liquid securities. Monthly data mitigate these distortions, but reduce sample size, widening confidence bands around alpha. Seasoned analysts therefore examine multiple horizons, cross-checking for stability. If a company's beta swings between 0.8 and 1.4, depending on the window, the prudent course is to treat the true beta as uncertain, widen the range of plausible expected returns, and temper position sizes accordingly. To continue, the CAPM framework gives us a clean verbal equation linking expected return to beta, the systematic risk metric derived from covariance and variance. Alpha, the intercept in the return on market regression, captures any performance unexplained by that beta. Jensen's alpha extends the idea from single securities to full portfolios, enabling risk-adjusted comparisons across managers and strategies. Each statistic carries specific assumptions and estimation cautions. Yet together, they offer a coherent set of tools for forecasting returns, sizing positions, and evaluating active skill. In the chapters ahead, we will test the model's limits, layer in additional factors, and show how modern portfolio construction software automates these calculations. A disciplined grasp of beta, expected return, and alpha equips any investor with the minimal grammar required to speak quantitatively about risk and reward. If the capital asset pricing framework were the last word on expected return, a single statistic, beta, would suffice for every investment decision. Yet decades of data have revealed a richer, more textured reality. Certain groups of securities, defined by simple, publicly observable characteristics, have persistently earned returns that are higher or lower than the single-factor model predicts. Among the most robust of these characteristics is recent price momentum. To put this concept into perspective, consider a real-world example. In the 1990s, a momentum strategy that bought the top-performing stocks and shorted the worst-performing ones would have yielded an average annual return of around 20% in the U.S. market. Close behind momentum are size, value, profitability, investment intensity, and low volatility. Together, they form the raw material for multi-factor models, the practical heirs to the elegant but incomplete single beta view. To anchor the discussion, consider a laboratory-style exercise first carried out in the early 1990s and repeated countless times since. Researchers take the full universe of common stocks listed in the United States, rank them at the end of each calendar month by their total return over the preceding 11 months, skipping the immediately previous month to avoid short-term reversal noise, and form two portfolios. A winner portfolio holding the top decile of performers and a loser portfolio holding the bottom decile. When they calculate the average monthly difference in return between the two sleeves, dubbed the momentum spread, they find a positive figure that is both economically sizable and statistically significant across many decades, even after realistic trading costs. For instance, a study covering the period from 1927 to 2019 found that the momentum spread averaged around 8% per annum. The single beta model, which predicts that only market co-movement should matter, cannot explain why past winners usually keep winning for several additional months. Momentum's persistence invites an obvious question: why does the pattern survive despite its public documentation? Two broad explanations dominate the scholarly debate. The first stresses behavioral biases. Investors, as a group, tend to underreact to genuinely new information. Earnings surprises, regulatory decisions, and technological breakthroughs often reach the market in fragments rather than in one neat package. If early news moves a stock upward, but investors only partially adjust their expectations, subsequent confirmatory signals push the price higher still, creating the slow-moving drift that momentum strategies harvest. A complementary bias, the disposition effect, leads many investors to sell winners too early in order to lock in gains and to hold on to losers too long in the hope of breaking even. Such behavior adds incremental supply to stocks that are already rising and incremental demand to those that are falling, reinforcing short to intermediate term trends. Research has shown, for example, that investors frequently liquidate positions after a 20% gain, triggering a temporary price drop. The second explanation points to market frictions. Large institutional investors frequently face mandates that constrain rapid repositioning. Pension funds must obtain committee approval before altering strategic weights. Mutual funds watch capital gains distributions. Insurance companies contend with statutory capital charges. These real-world constraints slow the flow of capital that might otherwise arbitrage away the momentum spread. Even when sophisticated traders attempt to exploit the pattern, their risk management rules and financing costs cap position sizes, preventing complete elimination of the anomaly. Consider, for instance, a pension fund that needs several months to secure approval for a new allocation. During that delay, the momentum spread can persist. Momentum alone, however, does not answer every empirical puzzle. Small capitalization shares have delivered higher average returns than large capitalization shares, even after accounting for higher volatility. Cheap stocks, those with low market price relative to book value, earnings, or cash flow, have outpaced expensive growth darlings over long horizons. Profitable companies, defined by high gross profits relative to assets, have beaten unprofitable peers, while firms that reinvest heavily have underperformed those that keep investment outlays modest. Each of these observations represents an additional factor in the expanding asset pricing toolkit. A portfolio of small-cap value stocks, for example, outperformed the broader market by roughly 5% per annum from 1963 to 2019. The modern multi-factor framework treats each characteristic as a portfolio in its own right. Imagine a long-short vector that is long cheap firms and short expensive firms. Call this the value factor. Another vector is long small firms and short large firms. That is the size factor. Yet another goes long profitable, conservatively financed businesses and shorts unprofitable, aggressively expanding firms. Label that quality. Combine these vectors with the traditional market factor and with momentum. The result is a linear model in which a security's expected excess return equals the sum of its exposures to each factor times the historical premium that factor has earned. By moving from one factor to several, the model captures far more of the cross-sectional variation in average returns than beta alone can explain. A portfolio manager who evaluates a candidate stock through this multi-lens approach gains a more complete understanding of its expected performance. Empirical validation follows a familiar recipe. Researchers run time series regressions of individual stock or portfolio returns on the full set of factor returns. The regression slopes quantify exposure, while the intercept, the multi-factor alpha, shrinks dramatically relative to what it had been under the single-factor version. In plain language, once we account for how much a stock tilts toward value, size, momentum, and profitability, very little unexplained return is left. The model's augmented explanatory power holds not only in the United States, but also across developed markets in Europe, Asia, and Oceania, and, though more noisily, in many emerging markets. One study, for instance, found that a multi-factor specification explained roughly 70% of the variation in average returns across countries. Why do these additional factors persist? Each carries its own blend of behavioral and structural rationales. Value and quality premia may compensate investors for the risk of companies falling into distress during recessions, a risk not fully captured by market beta. Size may reward bearing liquidity risk, since small stocks are harder to trade during market stress. Momentum, as already discussed, likely derives from information diffusion and investor psychology. Low volatility stocks, conversely, challenge classical theory by offering market-like returns with gentler swings. Here, the leading explanation is leverage aversion. Many institutional mandates prevent or discourage explicit leverage, pushing return-seeking investors into higher beta names and leaving quieter stocks under-demanded, which boosts their subsequent return per unit of risk. Translating these insights into a live portfolio begins with measurement. Factor exposures can be estimated directly from accounting variables and recent returns, then combined into a scoring system. A quantitative manager might compute a composite score for every tradable equity by Z-scoring each raw characteristic, such as book-to-market ratio, prior 12-month return excluding the most recent month and operating profitability, and then averaging. Securities ranking in the top quintile become candidates for overweight positions. Those in the bottom quintile become underweight or short positions, subject to liquidity screens and diversification rules. For instance, a manager may focus on undervalued stocks that also show strong momentum and high profitability. Implementation still confronts practical frictions. Turnover is a chief concern, especially for momentum, whose signals refresh monthly or even more frequently. Trading costs can devour the theoretical premium unless the portfolio is scaled to market depth and executed with patience. Many managers therefore pair momentum with slower moving factors like value and profitability. The combination offers two benefits. First, performance of the individual factors is imperfectly correlated. Momentum often struggles during sharp regime reversals, exactly when value tends to rebound. Blending them smooths the ride. Second, because the trades required by each factor partially offset, aggregate turnover falls, reducing cost drag. One common solution is to rebalance quarterly instead of monthly, thereby retaining most of the factor exposure while easing trading costs. Risk management also evolves in a multi-factor context. A portfolio constructed purely on value and momentum scores might inadvertently load on sectors, countries, or macro forces in ways not intended by the designer. Modern practice, therefore, layers a secondary optimization step. The manager starts with raw factor scores, then feeds them into an engine that seeks to maximize expected return per unit of forecast risk while imposing constraints. Sector exposures within predefined bands, currency neutrality, beta near unity, and turnover below a targeted annual rate. The engine may even penalize exposure to attributes deemed unrewarded, such as extreme illiquidity. The resulting portfolio is both factor-aware and broadly diversified. For those who wish to trial these ideas at the spreadsheet level, the mechanics are accessible. Download monthly total return histories for a diversified equity universe. Compute each stock's trailing 11-month momentum measure, its book-to-market ratio using the latest balance sheet data, and its market capitalization. Standardize each variable by subtracting the cross-sectional mean and dividing by the standard deviation. Sum the Z-scores to produce an aggregate factor score. Rank stocks and assign equal weight to the top decile. Finance this long position by shorting an equal dollar basket of bottom decile names. Record the monthly return of the long-short spread. Repeat over several decades. Even with transaction cost haircuts that grow with assumed turnover, the compounded edge remains visible, mirroring published academic results. Institutional portfolios rarely run fully dollar-neutral factor spreads. More common is the tilt approach, a core benchmark, often the Global Developed Market Index weighted by float-adjusted capitalization, forms the backbone. On top sits a modest factor overlay calibrated so that active risk, measured as the tracking error standard deviation relative to the benchmark, stays within policy limits, such as 2 to 4 percentage points per year. By dialing the overlay up or down, the sponsor can seek incremental return without straying far from peer comparisons or internal risk budgets. Because the factor lenses are transparent, trustees gain comfort that excess performance, good or bad, arises from identifiable, historically rewarded sources rather than from opaque market timing. Regulatory regimes have started to recognize the systematic nature of these approaches. Exchange-traded funds that follow published multi-factor indices have gathered substantial assets, offering everyday investors exposure to the same premia that sophisticated desks harvest internally. Although the packaging is new, the underlying arithmetic remains faithful to the academic lineage stretching from the early value papers of the 1970s through the momentum discoveries of the 1990s and onward to today's machine-assisted ranking engines. What of the future? As datasets expand beyond traditional financial statements into supply chain statistics, patent filings, and even satellite images of parking lot occupancy, new candidate factors inevitably surface. Yet history teaches a sober lesson. Most proposed signals fail out of sample, and many that succeed correlate strongly with existing factors once properly adjusted. The practical imperative is therefore disciplined skepticism. Any new variable should prove three qualities before entering a production model: a sound economic rationale, statistical robustness across markets and eras, and capacity to absorb real-world trading without eroding its own edge. To summarize, momentum, value, size, quality, and low volatility each represent repeatable, empirically grounded ways to tilt portfolios beyond the single market factor. Their persistence draws from a blend of behavioral quirks and structural constraints. When combined thoughtfully and executed with attention to cost, these factors can enhance expected return per unit of risk, provide diversification across economic cycles, and offer investors a clearer map of where performance truly comes from. Equipped with factor awareness, the modern portfolio architect steps into a broader opportunity set, moving from one-dimensional beta exposure toward a calibrated mosaic of distinct, measurable, tasty, and historically rewarded drivers of return. Imagine yourself seated in front of a blank spreadsheet, the grid stretching out before you like an empty canvas waiting to be filled. Our goal is to transform this empty grid into a functional laboratory where we can explore the principles of modern portfolio theory. We'll start from scratch, importing historical prices for a small set of liquid exchange-traded funds, transforming those prices into logarithmic returns, assembling a variance-covariance matrix, estimating individual betas against a broad market proxy, and finally using the spreadsheet's built-in optimizer to draw the efficient frontier. Every step will rely on functions already available in mainstream spreadsheet software, so no macros, add-ins, or external code are required. By the end, you'll understand that these calculations are feasible and you'll have a mental map of each cell and formula, ready to reproduce in your own workspace. To begin, open a fresh sheet and label the first column Date. Down this column, paste or type end-of-month trading dates in chronological order, with the earliest date at the top. Next, choose 5 well-known exchange-traded funds that span several asset classes. For example, a large capitalization United States equity fund, a developed market international equity fund, an investment-grade corporate bond fund, a treasury inflation-protected securities fund, and a broad commodities tracker. Picking up where we left off with the price sheet framework, across the top row, cells B1 through F1, enter short tickers or descriptive names for these 5 funds. Your header row now clearly labels each asset's column. The structure of this data table is akin to setting up a laboratory notebook where each column is a separate experiment, and the header row labels the contents of each test tube. To populate the sheet with data, visit a reliable free source like Yahoo Finance. Download each fund's adjusted close series at a monthly frequency to keep the file size manageable. Each download produces a comma-separated text file. Copy the entire column of adjusted closes, the field that already accounts for dividends and splits, and paste it into the sheet under the corresponding fund header. Repeat this process until all 5 price histories align beneath their labels. Take a moment to scroll downward and verify that every row shows a number for every fund. Gaps may occur if an instrument was launched after the earliest date in your range. If so, trim the top portion so that the first row with complete data becomes the new starting point. Consistent observation counts are critical for matrix operations later. For instance, if you're working with a dataset that starts in January, 2001 of your funds was launched in June 2000, you'll need to adjust your starting point to June 2000 so all columns share identical dates. With raw prices loaded, the spreadsheet now holds pure level information, not yet returns. Returns capture change, and mean variance analysis relies on these changes. In column G, label the header Market. Here, paste the adjusted close history for a broad, capitalization-weighted equity index fund that will serve as our market proxy when we estimate betas. Having the market proxy in its own column keeps subsequent formulas tidy. Move one sheet to the right and create a new worksheet called Returns. Copy the date column from the prices sheet and paste it into the first column here. Then, in cell B2, enter a formula that calculates the continuously compounded return between the latest price and the preceding price for the first fund. As you type, narrate the process, equals sign, letters L and N, open parentheses, click the prices sheet, click the latest price cell, type a forward slash to indicate division, click the prior price cell, close parentheses. Hit enter. The cell now displays the natural logarithm of 1 plus the simple percentage change, which is the continuous return we want. Drag that formula downward to the end of your data, then drag the entire filled column rightward across all asset columns, including the market proxy. Because relative references adjust automatically, each cell will look back one row within its own price series. Confirm by spot checking that the topmost return row remains blank. This is correct because the first date lacks a prior observation. At this point, every interior cell on the return sheet represents a monthly log return. The next step is to condense these many rows into summary statistics. Create a third worksheet and name it Stats. In its first column, list the 5 asset names plus the market proxy. Adjacent to each name, compute the average return and volatility. In cell B2, directly beside the first asset label, type equals sign, letters A, V, E, R, A, G, E, open parentheses, then highlight the entire return column for that asset on the returns sheet, close parentheses. Because we're working with log returns, the arithmetic average is a reasonable estimator of expected compound growth over long horizons. Press enter, then copy the formula downward for each asset and the market proxy. To calculate volatility, in cell C2, type equals sign, letters S, T, D, V dot, letter P, open parenthesis, highlight the same return column as before, close parenthesis. The dot P variant calculates the population standard deviation, which is appropriate when treating the sample as the whole set of observations. Copy this volatility formula downward as you did for the average. Your stats sheet now hosts an expected return column and a volatility column. A higher volatility indicates greater uncertainty or risk, much like how a wider swing on a seesaw signals more vigorous motion. Still on the stats sheet, scroll a few columns to the right and set up the variance-covariance matrix. Label the upper left entry of the matrix with the first asset name and mirror the full list across both the top row and the leftmost column so the matrix forms a square. In the first interior cell, the intersection of the first asset with itself, type equals sign, letters V, A, R dot, letter P, open parenthesis, select the full return column, close parenthesis. This produces the variance, which is simply volatility squared, but expressed in squared return units. For an off-diagonal entry, where asset 1 intersects asset 2, type equals sign, letters C, O, V, A, R, I, A, N, C, E dot, letter P, open parenthesis, select the first return column, comma, select the second return column, close parenthesis. Copy this formula through the rest of the grid, verifying that the covariance of asset A with asset B matches the covariance of asset B with asset A. Small rounding differences aside, perfect symmetry confirms consistent formulas. With the covariance matrix in hand, shift focus to beta estimation. Beta links each asset to the market via the definition, covariance between asset and market divided by variance of the market. On the stats sheet, insert a column titled beta. For the first asset, type equals sign, letters C, O, V, A, R, I, A, N, C, E, dot, letter P, open parenthesis, select the asset's return series, comma, select the market return series, close parenthesis, then type a forward slash, then letters V, A, R, dot, letter P, open parenthesis, select the market return series again, close parenthesis. Press enter, then copy downward. Each asset's beta now appears alongside its average return and volatility. You can sanity check by eyeballing the results. The corporate bond fund should show a beta well below 1, the equity funds near 1, and the commodities tracker somewhere in between, depending on the period. Now, create a fourth worksheet named Weights. In the first column, list the 5 asset names again. In the adjacent column, reserve cells for portfolio weights. Leave them blank for the moment. At the bottom of the weight column, add a cell labeled sum of weights, and in that cell type, equals sign. Then click the first weight cell, type a plus sign, click the second, and so on until all 5 are included. The optimization will later force this sum to equal 1, meaning 100% of capital is allocated. Next to the weight section, build 3 portfolio-level formulas, expected return, volatility, and beta. For expected return, use the dot product of the weight column with the expected return column from stats. The spreadsheet's sum product function accomplishes this elegantly. For volatility, you'll need to perform matrix algebra using the covariance matrix and the weights. First, name the weight range. Then, in the volatility cell, type equals sign. Letters S, Q, R, T, open parenthesis, letters M, M, U, L, T, open parenthesis, letters M, M, U, L, T, open parenthesis, weight range, comma, covariance matrix range, close parenthesis, comma, transpose of weight range, close parenthesis. The double M mult performs weight times covariance, then the resulting row vector times the transposed weight column, yielding portfolio variance. The outer square root converts that to standard deviation. Finally, compute portfolio beta with another sum product, weights times individual betas, from stats. With every mechanical component built, the optimization stage is next. Most widely used spreadsheet software ships with an add-in called Solver. Activate it if it's not already visible. Open Solver and set the objective cell to the volatility formula. Choose min because we'll ask Solver to minimize volatility for a given target return. In the decision variable box, reference the 5 weight cells. Now add constraints. Force the sum of weight cell to equal 1. Ensure each individual weight cell is greater than or equal to 0 if short selling is disallowed, and impose the expected return to be greater than or equal to a target that you specify in a separate input cell. Click Solve. In a few seconds, the optimizer proposes weights that hit the target return with the lowest possible volatility. Note down the resulting volatility in weights. To trace the full efficient frontier, repeat the procedure with a sequence of target returns. Begin slightly above the minimum individual expected return and increment in equal steps up to the maximum. For each target, change the target return cell, press solve again, and record the resulting volatility. When all pairs of returns and volatilities are collected, highlight them and insert a scatter chart. The familiar concave curve appears, starting with the global minimum variance portfolio at the leftmost point, then bowing upward and to the right as return targets rise. As you examine the frontier, consider how the optimizer is balancing the two to achieve the most rewarding blend for a stated risk appetite. Finally, verify consistency between the frontier results and the beta column. Compute the portfolio beta for each frontier point by applying the stored weights to individual betas via sum product. Plot those betas against portfolio volatilities on a second chart. You'll observe that beta and volatility often move in tandem, but not perfectly, illustrating that systematic risk, as captured by beta, is only one dimension of uncertainty. Total variance also embeds idiosyncratic and cross-asset interactions that beta alone cannot summarize. At this stage, the workbook functions as a living platform. Each month, when new price data arrive, append the latest row to the prices sheet, extend your return formulas by one row, and watch the efficient frontier shift minutely to reflect evolving market dynamics. Over time, you might enrich the model with transaction cost estimates or impose additional constraints such as maximum weight per asset class. Every such refinement rests on the foundation built here: cleaned prices, logarithmic returns, a properly symmetric covariance matrix, betas grounded in covariance math, and an optimizer translating those statistics into actionable weight recommendations. Before closing the file, save a backup under a new version name. This creates a chronological audit trail that will later help you dissect how the frontier migrated through different economic cycles. With that final precaution, our workshop concludes, leaving you with a complete quantitative toolkit, a transparent, replicable implementation of modern portfolio theory that you can expand at will. Once a portfolio has been carefully arranged along an efficient frontier and its expected returns seem sensible, the question arises: how do we know that the future will not bring a single day so violent that months of planning unravel? Three tools dominate contemporary answers: value at risk, stress testing, and risk parity allocation. Each offers a distinct lens on uncertainty, and each carries methodological disputes that practicing analysts must weigh before placing real capital behind the statistics. Value at risk, commonly pronounced by its initials, attempts to compress an entire probability distribution into one sentence. What is the most the portfolio is likely to lose over a specified horizon, expressed at a given confidence level? For instance, an analyst might say, at 95% confidence, our 10-day value at risk equals $5 million. This remark signals that only one observation in 20 is expected to exceed the stated loss during a 10-day window, given the model's assumptions. To put that figure in perspective, consider a portfolio manager who has allocated $100 million across various assets. A $5 million value at risk represents a 5% potential loss over the specified horizon. Three approaches now dominate the calculation of value at risk. The historical method gathers an unbroken series of past portfolio returns, orders them from best to worst, and selects the cutoff corresponding to the desired tail percentile. By relying on real data, it automatically respects fat tails, serial correlation, and regime shifts that actually occurred. During the 2008 financial crisis, many institutions discovered that their historical windows failed to encompass the extremity of new events, leaving them undercapitalized for genuine tail risk. The parametric approach assumes a particular distribution, often normal, occasionally T or skewed, and plugs estimated means, variances, and correlations into a closed-form formula. This can underestimate danger if the chosen distribution undersells skew or kurtosis. Banks that clung to bell curve assumptions saw repeated value at risk breaches during the same crisis because reality produced far more observations in the tails than a normal curve predicted. Monte Carlo simulation appears to offer middle ground, drawing thousands of random paths from a factor model calibrated to current volatilities and correlations. Yet it inherits any misspecification embedded in the chosen factors, and computational burden grows rapidly when instruments with embedded optionality must be repriced in each scenario. Real-time desks often compromise by running coarser grids overnight and reserving high-resolution runs for weekly risk reviews. Regulatory regimes on both sides of the Atlantic now force large dealers to backtest their declared value at risk against realized profit and loss series. If the number of breaches, days when actual losses exceed the predicted limit, runs too high, supervisors require the institution to multiply capital charges by a penalty factor. That discipline has prompted industry desks to complement value at risk with scenario analysis. Stress testing is best viewed as the narrative counterpart to probabilistic value at risk. Instead of asking, how bad can it get on average within a confidence band, a stress test asks, what happens if a specific nightmare comes true? For example, an analyst might bump every treasury rate upward by 200 basis points overnight, then revalue each bond, swap, mortgage, and equity against that new backdrop. Because the shift is imposed by fiat, no probability need be assigned. The aim is to understand exposure. Modern stress platforms go far beyond rate shocks, superimposing equity crashes, commodity collapses, sovereign defaults, or combinations that mimic known historical calamities. Yet, even stress testing invites controversy. Some observers argue that picking scenarios is an art closer to storytelling than to science, prone to hindsight bias and subjectivity. Others counter that judgment is precisely what converts raw statistics into a meaningful safeguard. No purely mechanical routine could have anticipated the joint dislocation of mortgage credit and interbank funding markets that defined the 2008 turmoil. A balanced program, therefore, couples systematic, repeating stresses, simple percentile jumps in rates and volatilities, with handcrafted narratives that evolve as new vulnerabilities appear. Risk parity shifts focus from measuring danger to distributing it. Traditional portfolios often begin with capital weights. If an investor wishes to hold 40% equities, 40% bonds, and 20% real assets, the optimization starts from those dollar shares. Risk parity inverts the procedure, asking each asset to contribute the same marginal slice of total portfolio volatility, regardless of how much capital that requirement implies. Because bonds and defensive commodities usually exhibit lower day-to-day swings than equities, equalizing risk typically demands a larger notional allocation to the calmer instruments and a smaller slice to the turbulent ones. As a result, the portfolio's aggregate variance can fall significantly relative to a capital-weighted benchmark, even before any leverage. Critics reply that risk parity is merely leverage in disguise. If an investor truly equalizes risk across bonds, equities, and inflation-protected notes, the low volatility blocks may dominate the dollar budget, dragging down expected return unless extra borrowing is employed to lift the entire structure back to a target yield. At that point, skeptics argue, one might as well admit to running a leveraged bond overlay rather than flying the risk parity banner. Another objection concerns factor concentration. By maximizing diversification of volatility, parity portfolios can end up heavily exposed to duration risk because interest rate instruments supply most of the low correlated ballast. To crystallize how these three lenses, value at risk, stress testing, and risk parity, interact in practice, consider a graduate student nearing the end of a capstone project. She has assembled a diversified portfolio of 12 exchange-traded funds spanning domestic equities, foreign developed equities, emerging markets, investment-grade credit, short and long treasury bonds, real estate trusts, gold, broad commodities, and two niche factors harvested via long-short equity baskets. Satisfied with her efficient frontier positioning, she runs a 95% 20-day historical value at risk calculation and discovers that one position, the Broad Commodities Fund, accounts for more than one-third of aggregate tail risk, even though it represents barely one-tenth of capital. Intrigued and concerned, she drills down. The commodity sleeve's exposure concentrates in energy futures, which during the sample endured several episodes of double-digit weekly declines. Next, she launches a suite of stress tests. One scenario imposes a rapid deflation shock reminiscent of the 1932 trough. Oil prices halve, industrial metals fall 40%, and long-dated treasury yields collapse. The simulated losses push the portfolio well beyond the value at risk estimate, breaching the institution's internal limit. A second scenario, drawn from the Persian Gulf supply disruptions of the early 1990s, does the opposite. Crude oil triples while equities stumble. Under that path, the portfolio rallies, masking the asymmetric danger posed by the earlier deflationary case. Armed with both findings, the student decides to experiment with risk parity rebalancing. She allows the optimizer to enlarge her treasury and inflation-protected bond sleeves, shrink the commodity allocation, and borrow modestly against cash to restore targeted expected return. The revised mix now shows each asset contributing roughly 8% of total volatility and cuts the historical value at risk by nearly one quarter. When she presents the project, faculty reviewers focus less on the specific percentages and more on the disciplined interplay of metrics. Value at risk alerted her to a hidden concentration. Stress testing translated that abstract concentration into a concrete scenario familiar to decision makers. Risk parity supplied a systematic avenue for adjustment while flagging the borrowing trade-off. By blending these perspectives, the student demonstrates that rigorous risk control is not a single rule applied in isolation, but a dialogue among complementary methods, each probing the portfolio from a different angle and each challenging the comforting assumptions that can lull even the most sophisticated optimizer into complacency. Before any optimizer can trace a sleek, efficient frontier, before any risk dashboard can warn that momentum exposure has crept above policy bands, millions of raw observations must traverse cables, clouds, and databases without losing either precision or context. Data are the bloodstream of quantitative investment, and the infrastructure that moves, cleans, and validates those data often determines whether a research insight becomes a dependable trading edge or a costly mirage. In this section, we chart that infrastructure, beginning with the public feeds that tempt newcomers, moving through the premium services that dominate institutional desks, and ending with the mundane but essential routines, storage architecture, cleaning scripts, and validation checks that keep the entire machine from veering off course. To start, consider the appeal of free sources. A graduate student can, in a single afternoon, pull decades of adjusted closing prices from Yahoo Finance, daily treasury yields from the St. Louis Federal Reserve, and inflation series from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Using the YFinance library in Python, one can download adjusted closes for every constituent of the S&P 500 in less time than it takes to brew coffee. All three sources are accessible through human-readable web pages and through RESTful APIs that expose comma-separated values on demand. The zero price tag encourages experimentation. Alternative rebalance frequencies, different factor definitions, or entirely new asset classes can be tested at negligible marginal cost. However, the same ease hides structural weaknesses. In May 2017, Yahoo quietly altered the query endpoint that thousands of hobbyists and a fair number of small advisors relied upon, causing scheduled scripts to return empty files overnight. Furthermore, corporate action adjustments occasionally lag. For example, a student extracting Apple's history the morning after the company's 4-for-1 split in mid-2020 would have found unadjusted pre-split prices alongside post-split prices, creating a visually alarming overnight drop. Unless the downstream code flagged that drop as a split and not a market collapse, the portfolio optimizer would react by slashing the weight or even signaling an erroneous short. Index composition histories are also seldom included, leading to survivorship bias. Each of these pitfalls can be mitigated, but mitigation requires vigilance and redundant vendors. Institutional desks, therefore, pay for feeds whose value lies not just in breadth, but in contractual reliability and governance. Bloomberg's Terminal, Refinitiv's Data Stream, and S&P Global's Capital IQ all bundle tick-level equities, futures, options, and economic releases, each stamped with nanosecond timestamps and groomed by teams that reconcile splits, dividends, and symbol changes before the data reach the client. These vendors provide audit trails that meet compliance requirements no volunteer-maintained site can satisfy. The downside is cost, with a single desktop license running into the mid-five figures in US dollars per year. Hence, many mid-sized managers adopt a hybrid model: premium feeds for live trading and time-sensitive corporate actions, and open feeds for exploratory research where occasional gaps pose no financial risk. Either way, the data must travel through code, where modern APIs have democratized tasks once reserved for low-level network engineers. A typical workflow launches in a high-level language such as Python or R, calls a RESTful endpoint over HTTPS, receives a JSON payload, and parses it into an in-memory data frame. To avoid overwhelming the server, rate limits, often phrased as so many calls per minute or day, enforce polite usage. Exceed the quota, and the server replies with an error status, so the client must incorporate exponential backoff or token bucket throttling to avoid a hard stop. Once retrieved, the data should reside in a suitable storage solution. Local spreadsheets suffice for toy examples, but even a modest multi-asset shop accumulates terabytes. Cloud object stores, such as Amazon S3, Microsoft Azure Blob, and Google Cloud Storage, offer near-infinite capacity, automatic replication across availability zones, and versioning that preserves every historical change. To manage costs, teams should be mindful of storage per gigabyte, request overhead, and data egress fees. Experienced teams therefore spin up cloud compute instances in the same region as the data, perform analysis in place, and download only aggregated results. Raw files by themselves are inert. Data engineering turns them into analyzable tables through structural and contextual passes. The first pass confirms that every record includes a primary key, drops duplicate rows, and standardizes column names. The second pass adjusts equity prices for splits and cash dividends, forward fills missing bond yields, and converts time zones so that global market closes align to a single 24-hour clock. Ignoring these steps can cause simple statistics to mislead, such as showing imaginary arbitrage opportunities in a study of overnight returns across regions due to mismatched timestamps. Cleaning alone is not validation. Validation asks whether the clean series still looks economically plausible and internally consistent. Dimensional checks, range checks, and outlier detection routines help identify potential issues. For instance, a foreign exchange rate jumping from $1.2 per euro to $12 per euro overnight is likely a provider glitch or an unadjusted redenomination. A vendor once reversed the direction of a widely used sovereign credit default swap series, making widening spreads appear as tightening risk, an error caught only through cross-checking against a second feed. Cross-vendor reconciliation is the strongest defense against silent failures. A simple script can download the S&P 500 closing level from two independent providers, calculate the percentage difference, and alert if the gap exceeds a threshold such as one basis point. On one Friday afternoon in early 2015, a northeastern United States snowstorm forced the New York Stock Exchange to close early, but one minor feed continued timestamping quotes until the usual 4 o'clock bell, causing a mismatch that automated reconciliations caught. Even trustworthy feeds may report late, such as corporate action data, which can induce trading errors if not properly managed. In 2019, a mid-cap biotechnology firm announced a reverse split effective the next week, but one data vendor posted the event within minutes, while another updated the file 2 days later. Portfolios that ingested the late file found their position sizes quadrupled relative to market value, triggering internal leverage limits and freezing trading until the true share count could be verified. Beyond equities, macroeconomic releases also require careful handling. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics posts non-farm payroll numbers precisely at 8:30 a.m. Eastern Time on the first Friday of each month. High-frequency funds pay for co-location in data centers to shave milliseconds off the path from the secure release site to their matching engines. A simple calendar file maintained by hand once a month can prevent ingestion delays and the embarrassment of trading on stale figures. After data arrive clean and validated, the last link is reproducibility. Every transformation should leave an audit trail. Modern approaches store raw files, cleaned files, and transformed analytical sets in separate buckets, along with metadata that lists the code version, parameter settings, and timestamp. This allows researchers to recreate the exact input environment that generated a particular result, compare it with today's pipeline, and isolate whether any divergence stems from an intentional methodological upgrade or a silent data drift. Taken together, these episodes underline a sober conclusion. Data infrastructure is no mere back-office utility. It is an active risk factor, one that interacts with every statistical method described in earlier chapters. A covariance matrix built on unadjusted splits will misstate diversification. A factor score computed on stale fundamentals will send weights in the wrong direction. A latency spike in a real-time feed can upend stop-loss logic designed to cap drawdowns. Building redundancy, validation, and transparent lineage into the pipeline is therefore as important as selecting the right optimization routine. By this point in the program, we have examined each architectural beam of quantitative investing in isolation. We possess a working knowledge of factor portfolios, a catalog of risk metrics, a blueprint for data sanitation, and a method for decomposing returns into skill-based and market-based elements. The final task is to assemble those parts into a repeatable, audit-ready process that can govern billions of dollars with the same mechanical reliability that laboratory standards bring to biomedical research. Only then will a portfolio graduate from a clever spreadsheet to an enduring enterprise asset. We begin with objectives because every engineering design starts by specifying the load-bearing requirements. An institutional sponsor, say, a public pension or a university endowment, whose board has formally adopted three guiding targets, provides a clear framework. First, the portfolio must deliver a real return of 3 percentage points above consumer inflation over rolling decade-long windows. Second, realized volatility must remain close to 10 percentage points per year, acknowledging that a smoother path aids spending policies and stakeholder psychology. Third, the investment program must align with the sponsor's environmental, social, and governance charter, which disallows certain revenue lines and encourages allocation toward decarbonization leaders. A 3% real return target is modest compared with historical equity performance, yet still challenging in a low-rate environment. These three mandates, return, risk, and responsibility, compose the outer frame within which every quantitative decision must fit. With guardrails clarified, the investment office drafts a reference model portfolio that reflects long-term capital market assumptions. The starting mix might devote one half of the risk budget to global public equities, one quarter to rate-sensitive fixed income, and the balance to diversifying real assets and alternative risk premia. Each building block is further decomposed into factor exposures. The equity sleeve is not a monolith, but a mosaic of market beta, value, quality, and momentum tilts, each harvested through transparent rules. Fixed income allocation is split into duration, credit, and inflation factors. Real assets contribute both a carry component and an inflation hedge characteristic. Every dollar of portfolio weight is immediately translated into a vector of factor loadings, enabling a richer dialogue between intended positioning and measured outcomes. Data flow design sits directly beneath that factor map. The institution licenses two independent market data feeds to ensure redundancy, one from a global vendor known for ultra-low latency equity ticks, and the other from a provider that specializes in corporate actions and fundamental updates. Each evening, an automated pipeline pulls the day's files into a cloud object store located within the same geographic region as the primary compute cluster. This proximity minimizes transfer lag and egress cost. A first-pass validation script confirms that every security identifier arriving from feed A matches a sibling record from feed B on price level within a tolerance band of 5 basis points and on share count within 1 share in 10,000. Any mismatches trigger an alert that routes to both the data engineering team and the risk control desk. Only after dual feed reconciliation do records move into the golden source table that powers live analytics. With clean, reconciled inputs secured, factor exposures are recomputed overnight. The engine constructs long-short portfolios that embody value, momentum, size, low volatility, and quality in the FAMA French tradition. For environmental, social, and governance alignment, the process now adds 2 specialized vectors, a carbon efficiency factor, ranking firms by Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions, normalized by revenue, and a governance quality factor built from board independence metrics and shareholder rights scores. Each factor's daily return series is stored alongside its rolling 12-month volatility and its most recent 5-year Sharpe ratio, all expressed in spelled-out percentages to keep units explicit. This historical library feeds both portfolio construction and performance attribution. Construction proceeds in 2 layers. The strategic layer sets slow-moving factor weights to match the sponsor's long-term policy. Strategic analysis might assign 40% of total risk to market beta, 15% each to value and quality, 10% to momentum, 10% to low volatility, and the remaining 10% to the governance and carbon factors combined. The tactical overlay tilts those weights modestly based on near-term signals, such as widening factor spreads, macroeconomic surprises, or shifts in monetary policy regimes. A maximum tracking error constraint of 3 percentage points caps the total deviation of tactical weights from the strategic budget, ensuring that opportunistic moves do not overshadow policy intent. Risk control is paramount. The institution maintains a tripartite risk system comprised of value at risk, stress scenarios, and real-time factor contribution analysis. Value at risk is calculated each night using a 10-year rolling window of daily returns, bootstrapped through a 1-stage block bootstrap to preserve serial correlation. The model outputs a 95% 5-day value at risk number that must not exceed 3% of net asset value. Stress tests run in parallel. They include historical episodes such as the global financial crisis, the dot-com unwind, and the pandemic drawdown, plus bespoke forward-looking shocks. Any scenario that projects a drawdown beyond 8% triggers an escalation workflow requiring chief investment officer sign-off before the next market open. While absolute and stress metrics guard the downside, factor contribution analysis keeps the portfolio aligned with its architecture. Each morning, the risk dashboard shows how much of the forecast value at risk arises from market beta, from each style factor, and from residual specific risk. If any single factor accounts for more than 1/3 of predicted volatility, or if residual risk slips below 1/4, the system flags an imbalance. Real-time transparency prevents creeping unintended bets, the silent enemies of disciplined strategy. The final pillar is performance attribution. At month end, when custodial statements close, the office performs a Brinson-type attribution that divides active return into allocation, selection, and interaction effects across sectors, regions, and factors. A parallel multi-factor regression attributes the same active return to the 7 explicit factors plus an intercept. Ideally, the intercept alpha hovers near 0, confirming that realized performance stems from the chosen systematic exposures rather than unexplained noise. Where discrepancies arise, the research team investigates whether new, unmodeled factors are influencing returns or whether estimation errors have crept into factor libraries. All these computations feed an integrated governance loop. The investment committee receives a concise but data-rich report every quarter. Tables show long-term targets, current exposures, recent changes, and out-of-policy exceptions in language accessible to trustees who may not live inside the modeling apparatus. Crucially, the report links carbon intensity metrics to both sector allocation and factor tilts, illustrating that low-carbon orientation flows through every stage of construction rather than residing in a separate ethical silo. Two technological currents promise to reshape the craft: machine learning and richer sustainability data. Machine learning's first institutional successes have come from pattern recognition inside high-dimensional data. Gradient-boosting algorithms assist in predicting one-day-ahead volatility, allowing leverage to ratchet down when turbulence looks imminent and to normalize when calm prevails. Deep learning sequence models parse earnings call transcripts, labeling sentences by sentiment, uncertainty, and forward-looking statements. The resulting sentiment scores feed the momentum factor, refining it beyond raw past returns into a hybrid that blends price action with linguistic nuance. Governance processes require that every machine-generated signal come with an audit trail, ensuring transparency and accountability. Environmental, social, and governance analytics are experiencing a parallel data renaissance. Satellite imagery quantifies methane flaring, shipborne sensors track global supply chains, and blockchain-verified provenance certificates attest to sustainable sourcing. Such datasets supplement traditional corporate disclosures, reducing reliance on self-reported numbers that may lag real behavior. Early experiments show that melding emissions path consistency with traditional profitability metrics yields a composite factor that predicts both lower downside risk and steady cash flow growth. As regulatory taxonomies tighten, incorporating these alternative data streams into risk budgets will shift from a voluntary branding exercise to a fiduciary requirement. The unifying lesson is that advanced tools do not replace the portfolio blueprint, they enrich it. Factor accounting, robust risk discipline, and transparent data lineage remain the spine. Machine learning sharpens forecasts at the margin, while environmental, social, and governance data introduce new constraints and opportunities that thoughtful optimization can harness. Together, they promise a future in which capital deployment honors both mathematical rigor and societal mandate. We close with the humble covariance matrix. Harry Markowitz showed that when we understand how pieces move together, we can arrange them into a structure stronger than any single component alone. Decades later, that principle still guides institutional investors. The only difference is scale. What started as a handful of asset classes in a research paper now involves thousands of securities, dozens of factors, kilohertz data feeds, and terabytes of environmental metrics. The craft endures. Measure, predict, constrain, iterate. Equipped with the integrated process we have just mapped, factor models married to reliable risk control, powered by industrial-grade data pipelines, and judged by transparent performance attribution, the modern investment office can navigate complexity with confidence. It can pursue competitive returns, respect rigorous risk limits, and reflect the evolving values of its stakeholders, all without sacrificing the statistical clarity that is the hallmark of quantitative finance. Thank you for choosing Astory Publishing.